WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. My guest's real name is Stephen, but since his last name is Lids, he changed his first name to Franz when he was 16. He was under the influence of his uncle Harry, who always called him Franz Lids, like the composer. But Harry was crazy, as were Franz's three other uncles, Leo, Arthur, and Danny. Leo, a brilliant, prolific, and unpublished writer, spent the last 34 years of his life in mental institutions. Harry, who believed he was the retired, undefeated boxing champion of the world, was released from his institution in the late 1960s. Arthur and Danny shared an apartment in the Bronx, cluttered with the results of Arthur's obsessive scavenging. Franz Lids has written about life with his four uncles and his eccentric father in the new memoir Unstrung Heroes. Lids first wrote about his uncles in Sports Illustrated, where he regularly writes about offbeat topics. To give you the flavor of the book, here's Franz Lids with an excerpt.
My uncles are smelly, screwy, astonishingly scrawny old guys who had abandoned everyday life. The world had packed them away in a back closet, like old sweaters. They still managed to pop up at the most inappropriate moments, subverting my mother's insistence on good manners and personal hygiene, and making a joke out of my father's cold scientific detachment. As a boy, I happily enlisted in their conspiracy against sanity. Now, as I write about these flickering men, I realize they kept me reasonably sane. Uncles, especially bachelor uncles, fill some odd cranny in families. They provide a hideout from the crushing commonplaces of our mothers and fathers. What do they know about kids? They give odd presents, never useful, mostly eccentric. They don't have to say no. It once seemed to me that every family I knew had at least three crazy uncles. Now, if you have one, you have to cherish them. I had four. Uncle Leo, the literary genius, Uncle Danny, the paranoid, Uncle Harry, the self-proclaimed world champ, and Uncle Arthur, the connoisseur who had amassed the world's most exhaustive shoelace collection. They were at once close and inaccessible. I never thought of them as young, but they didn't seem as grown up as other adults. They lived outside the mainstream, old Reds who had survived the coffee house and delicatessen revolutions of the Lower East Side. My uncles were sons of immigrants, heirs of the shtetl, the ghetto, the pogroms, dwellers outside the pale. But they were happy to be outsiders. They never had to make the same compromises true adults did. They remained innocent and faithful to their own loopy dreams.
So what did these uncles do for you? What did it help you with to have these, like, wacky uncles around?
Well, I mean, my mother was dying of cancer, and my father became more and more detached, being a scientist, and inaccessible. And they provided me with sort of a safe haven. You know, they were very cartoonish. They seemed to be jarred out of the square frame. And they reminded me a little of Wile E. Coyote. If they had walked off the edge of a cliff, I don't think they would have fallen down unless they looked down, which, of course, was sort of not in their character.
I'm interested in their individual madnesses. Like Uncle Danny was the paranoid uncle. How was his paranoia expressed?
Well, you know, he was the guy who he hated women except for his mother, and he wouldn't go to a horse race if a filly were running. So he basically stayed in his apartment with my uncle Arthur, who was the collector, who had this huge cavern of junk. And Danny saw everyone as sort of an actor who was playing out this devious little playlet that was just there to make him vulnerable and kind of crush his will. And there's a scene where, on my eighth birthday, where we go to Yankee Stadium together, and he's, by the end of the game, he's just sort of cowering under the seats because he thinks Mickey Mantle is aiming foul balls at him. And then he sees Bob Turley is pitching for the Yankees, and Casey Stengel slouches out to the mound, and he thinks they're plotting a pogrom. So he was totally at the mercy of this demonic director who was controlling his life.
And you enjoyed this when you were a kid?
Oh, it was terrific, just because no one else was acting this way, and they seemed to follow their own rules. And by their example, I thought that I could sort of escape into this this sort of funhouse world where everything was by different sets of criterion and rules. So
it got scary sometimes too, though, didn't it?
Sure. In that apartment on the 8th birthday, I became lost in these passageways. It was just because it was just caverns and catacombs and newspapers and junk. And when it got dark, there was sort of no way to find your way. And I just got lost and thought I was going to die. I had asthma at the time, which is really the only thing I have in common with Proust. So I started inhaling all this newspaper dust, and I just was rocking back and forth and lost in this strange world.
Now, your Uncle Harry, I think it was, the champion uncle, who was institutionalized for a while.
Right.
So it really thought of himself as a boxing champion, and he once sent you this letter that you reprint in the book, and there's a sketch of him in their boxing shorts in the ring,
right.
And then beneath it well, it doesn't reprint very well on the page, but he's written a lot of stuff very densely in small handwriting about, you know, his championship and all this. But you wrote him back a letter asking him, like, to tell you more about, like, the specifics of the bouts that he won. I mean, you were really taking it. Were you taking it at face value, or were you just trying to get into the hallucination?
Well, I just enjoyed it, and I wanted to see how much of it he really believed and how far into it he'd go. And, of course, he wrote me back this letter that said, "On March 28, 1932, I was challenged by Thratcher Muggs Charlemagne Fitzsimmons, alias Otto, alias King Willie of Germany, alias Apocalypse Death. I stopped him in the second round with 3 solid rights. The referee made me watch the count." So I wrote him back a letter and said, "Well, why did he stop the fight?" And so his letter, as usual, came in one of these double-sealed envelopes marked special delivery, and it said, all it said was, "I broke his head." So, I mean, that was an answer in itself that's perfectly acceptable to me. It sort of spurred me on to a career in sports writing.
Did it really?
Well, not really, but he, I wrote a story about him in 1983, and that's really what this book came out of.
My guest is Franz Lids. He's the author of a new memoir called Unstrung Heroes, My Improbable Life with 4 Impossible Uncles. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Franz Lids is my guest. In your book, you write that what is endearing in an uncle can be deplorable in a father. How much of the hallucinations and paranoia and eccentricity did your father share that your uncles had?
I think he had elements of all the uncles, and he tried his best to deny them, and that's why he had this great love for reason, which in the end, you know, wasn't sufficient to ward off the insanity. But he always wanted to be part of society and unlike his brothers, and was never willing to really accept this legacy of 4 truly insane brothers, and that he was the 5th one. And I think it's the resolution is only reached at the end of the book, where he, through chemotherapy for his own leukemia, sort of flips out into this own world and truly becomes one of his brothers.
One of your father's real eccentricities was this obsession with punning. I mean, it was almost an affliction with him, because he would pun all the time, and sometimes he would just hide behind puns. He wouldn't have to communicate with anybody, because he would just make these elaborate puns. But there's a really funny passage in which your third grade teacher comes to the house for dinner, and your father starts punning like crazy. Would you read that part for us?
Sure. I would say that I think punning is antisocial behavior. I've come to believe that a joke sort of enhances or at least encourages a conversation, whereas a pun just stops it dead. And I'm sort of afflicted with that virus at times myself, and I have to really stop myself. But in any event, it begins. My mother is there at this feast. She's fixed for the third grade teacher. And she says to my father, "Remember, watch the puns," she warned my father when Miss Clark rang the doorbell. It was no use. My father's mind was a motor that didn't have an off switch. "What part of England are you from?" asked my mother as we sat down to eat. I was raised in Nottingham, Miss Clark replied. I was raised in Manhattan, said my father. Fortunately, the rope broke. Robin Hood lived in Nottingham, I said. Very good, said Miss Clark. Tell me, said my father, when Robin Hood went to bed, did Friar tuck him in? Miss Clark smiled politely. Get me turtle soup, Selma, said my father, and make it snappy. My mother smiled politely. Miss Clark said she'd be taking my class on frequent visits to the public library. I want my students to get in the habit of looking things up. That sounds terrific, said my mother. When I was a boy, said my father, I'd go to the library to look up dresses. My mother's brows fused in a deep furrow of displeasure. My father, however, had already launched a long arpeggio of corniness. Ralph Will, Grant Wood. Frederick Schall, Bobby Shantz. Elaine May, Gallery Might. Kubla Khan. After a coy pause, he added, but Immanuel Kant. Miss Clark seemed dazzled by this show of erudition. You'd be a worthy candidate for Mensa, Mr. Lids, she said. What's that? Asked my father. A place for women who have problems with their periods?
Was your mother always cautioning your father about not punning, trying to restrain him?
It was only when there was company over, and you couldn't shut him off. But she never really had that same assault. That she had reached this kind of inner place with him that he understood that he couldn't sort of fend her off with puns and use wordplay as a shield. So she was the only one I'd ever met who was able to reach him that way.
Now, you talked about puns being a way of avoiding dealing with people. I'm reminded of a part in your memoir where you call up a girl who you have a crush on, and she says, do you know my father died? And you say, no, but if you hum a few bars, I'll fake it. And I was like, what a horrible, horrible joke. As if that joke wasn't old and tired enough as it was, right?
That's right.
To say that to someone whose father just died. I mean, did you have any idea what you were doing?
No, I was... Puns had become so reflexive at that point that I just couldn't stop, and I felt myself becoming more and more like my father. And there seemed to be almost no way out. Jim, I was just moored in these dead responses that were disconnected to any emotion. And that was during my adolescence when I was at war with my stepmother anyway, so I just had this great sense of self-loathing, and that only sort of added to the whole malaise, I guess.
Your book is both funny and tragic. You know, funny because you tell a lot of stories in a very funny way, and you put things in a humorous light. But it's tragic in the sense, you know, your mother dies, a couple of your uncles are kind of certifiably mad. Mm-hmm. And you end up stuck with a stepmother who you don't get along with. So it's a tragic book in a lot of ways. But I'm just wondering if you ever worry about your own mental health. I mean, coming from a family where there seems to be an almost genetic problem with madness.
Well, I don't. I mean, it sort of confirms my belief that there is sort of it is in the genes and not a behavioral thing, but it never... really occurred to me because I think I have a lot of my mother's grounding. And I mean, I can, my sister I'd worry about more, but I think the abstraction is what I got most out of them, that sense of just being able to look at things a little obliquely. And as far as craziness, I think the line is blurred anyway between so-called normality and craziness anyway, and it's almost a societal definition. If you're put in an asylum or can't function, then you're considered crazy. But, you know, so-called normal people have many of the attributes, or at least a lot of the idiosyncrasies of crazy people. And I see in my own, well, I have two daughters, Gogo and Dee Dee. Actually, Dee Dee's name is Daisy Daisy, but the contraction is Dee Dee, so we'd have the two protagonists from Waiting for Godot. Anyway, Gogo, I see as kind of a figure who has the capacity to spin out in space, and I have to reel her in. And a few months ago, we were in the Franklin Institute, which is the science museum in Philadelphia, and she was looking at all the exhibits on pendulums and propulsions and the laws of nature. So when we left the museum, she asked me if she could have a pretzel. So I said, sure. I bought her a pretzel. She takes the wax paper and drops it casually into the trash can and starts giggling. So I said, what's so funny? And she says, gravity. So I think it could be a good thing just to be able to look at the world from sort of a crazy angle.
Franz Lids is the author of the memoir Unstrung Heroes, My Improbable Life with Four Impossible Uncles. This is Fresh Air.